The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the author events office, and also a person who you probably just saw rolling around on the floor with a dog out there when you came in. I'm very excited to be here tonight to introduce Dave Barry, both because I very much enjoy his work, and I coincidentally have an old happy dog named Lucy in my family with whom my mom is trying to convince me at some point to video chat. Anyway, on to tonight's festivities. A 30-year writer at the Miami Herald, whose column was syndicated in more than 500 newspapers, Dave Barry won the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1988. His more than 30 New York Times best-selling books include I'll Mature When I'm Dead, Insane City, You Can Date When You're 40, and Dave Barry Slept Here, A Sort of History of the United States. Two of Barry's books were used as the basis for a CBS TV sitcom, Dave's World, starring the late, great Harry Anderson. Two of his articles have been included in the Best American Sports Writing Series. He was the 2005 winner of the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism, and he has been instrumental in publicizing and popularizing International Talk Like a Pirate Day. September 19th, set your calendars. Mr. Barry is also a member of the Rock Bottom Remainders, a rock and roll supergroup of sorts, made up of fellow writers, including at various times Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, Barbara Kingsolver, Scott Turow, among many others. His new book is called Lessons from Lucy, The Simple Joys of an Old Happy Dog, a guide to aging, making new friends, letting go of anger, and a host of other pearls of wisdom. It is a guide to joyous living. Stephen King, another of Mr. Barry's Rock Bottom Remainders bandmates, calls it insightful and downright touching, also adding that you'll also want to read it if you're a dog lover, but that's optional. These are very lively life lessons, even for the canine impaired, which I know none of you are. Here to translate this philosophy of his four-legged friend, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow dog aficionados, join me in welcoming Dave Barry back to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason. Thank you all for coming out. And thanks to the Paws Animal Rescue Group. Is Rex the dog around somewhere? There was a dog here. Okay. There really was a dog. I saw it. Yeah. Okay, there's a dog. You already own that dog, though, right? Yeah. Be careful here, because people will adopt it. Anyway, so, first of all, it's nice to be back in Philadelphia. This is where I got my journalism. I went to college in Haverford College. Trust me, it was a lot easier then. It was the 60s. I was in a rock band called the Federal Duck that we played at every college in the Delaware Valley area. I saw more fraternity brothers throw up on their dates than you want to even think about. And I got my journalism start at the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania, so, yeah. So, anyway, this book is a little bit of a departure for me. It's a little bit, I mean, I hope it's funny, but it's a little bit of a self-help book, and that is not normal for me. Usually, when people read one of my books, they're done, they go, that didn't help me at all. Yeah. You know, I feel a little bit stupider having read that book. But the idea behind it was, I have a dog, a rescue dog named Lucy. We got about 10 years ago. She is a big black dog. People always ask what she was. I finally got her DNA test done, where you take a swab from their cheek and send it off to I don't know where. For all I know, they make it up. Anyway, they said that Lucy is half boxer, a quarter Dalmatian, an eighth chow chow, think of the sex, and an eighth retriever, which makes her a purebred box mason chowtriever. Good breed to have. So anyway, Lucy's been my dog for really over 10 years now. And the impetus for the book was last year I turned 70. So big milestone. There was no accomplishment. Just don't die, really. That's my secret. And yeah, thank you. And at the same time, same year I turned 70, Lucy turned 10. So dog year, she was also 70. So we're both kind of at a milestone age, namely old. And I got to thinking, as you do, it's a big one to turn, to take stock of your life a little bit. And it occurred to me that Lucy was doing a much better job of aging than I was. She was just handling it better in every way. She was much, much more relaxed and joyful and happy about it. Obviously completely unaware that she had turned anything, you know, which is part of her secret. So, and I don't like it. I mean, I'll be really, I don't like aging. I'm opposed to it. Bad things happen to you when you turn 70. A really bad thing happens to your memory, particularly names, nouns in general, really, but names in particular. And for a lot of your, you know, sentences, you do need nouns. So I'll be making some point, you know, and I'll get to an aim, and I go, and even that hurts because I have arthritis. I go, you know, the guy, that guy in the place with the thing. And this starts a game of charades. And 20 minutes later, they figure out that you mean Hitler. And you can't remember what you were trying to say about Hitler, so that's one bad thing. Medically, aging is not great. I won't go into too much detail, except to say that I don't really care what the medical profession does, but they need to find a way to get to the prostate gland other than the way they're getting to it now. People say, what do you want? I'll tell you what men want. We want a procedure where the doctor stands 85 yards away and goes, looks good from here, Dave. Like, and then your mail, even your mail gets depressing. It's remarkable how much mail I get related to catheters. Also, you get a lot of mail, and this starts actually way before you turn 70. It really starts around when you turn 50. You get a lot of mail from ARP. ARP is, of course, the last sound you make before you die. ARP! You know. Hurry, doctor, he's ARPing over here, you know. But it's also an abbreviation for the American Association of Retired People standing in line ahead of you asking for a discount on every freaking thing. And, you know, I know ARP means well, and ARP is trying to help us older people, but some of the things they do are just ridiculous. Some of the things they say in their mail, basically they have this whole attitude that you shouldn't believe that getting old is bad. That, you know, it's great, it's just a new opportunity, there's no limits on what you can do, that's bullshit. I see evidence of this regularly. And I know that I have, you know, declined in many ways, and you are just less capable of certain things when you get to be older. Technological things tend to be high in the list of things you get less good at as you get older. And I know when I go on a book tour, as I am on now, you do signing, very often people want to take pictures, which is very flattering, it's very nice. But I've noticed there's a distinct difference between the way old people take pictures and the way young people take pictures. Here is how a young person takes a picture. They hold up the phone, they take the picture. That's how they do it. Here's how an older person takes a picture. They hold up the phone, they go, wait a minute. Okay, smile. No, wait, it's on Google. And then they tap the phone a little bit more and say, okay, smile. Oh no, it's taking a video. Wait a minute. And then tap the phone a little bit more and say, okay, smile. Wait a minute, took a picture of me. And then they give the phone to a young person. who takes the picture. So, driving, another area where I think when you get older, you're just not as good at it. I mean, we want to think we are, but we're not. I live in Miami. I moved there in 1986 from the United States. And there are South Florida, we have a lot of older drivers. I'm one of them. And we have people driving, couples driving, according to what I call the seeing eye wife system. So some of you know where I'm going with this. I have ridden in cars driven by this system. The system is the man drives. Why? Because the man drives, okay? But the man can no longer see. He has outsourced the seeing to his wife, who's like, it's an arrow, Harry. No, not that way, you know? This is a true story. About 5 years ago, Miami police stopped a 72-year-old man driving a Chevrolet Cobalt. Now, that in itself is not so weird. Police stopped a 72-year-old man driving a Cobalt. It's where they stopped him, and this is absolutely true. Runway 9, Miami International Airport. That really happened. This man, without realizing it, burst through a perimeter gate, and when they finally stopped him, he was on the runway. And to me, that shows a lack of awareness on the part of the moment. I don't know about you. If I'm driving and I notice I'm tailgating a 757, I'm going to say, whoa, I'm not on the interstate anymore here, am I? So, but our kind of tends to our, they want you to believe none of that's happening. They have this campaign called Disrupt Aging, and they say, you know, nothing is beyond your capabilities. Well, enough with these stereotypes about older drivers, older people, and you're never too old for anything. That's the ARP motto in this Disrupt Aging campaign. And I'm thinking, like, really, ARP, never too old for anything? What about airline pilots? Airline pilots now have to retire at age 65. I think most of them probably are fine flying at that age still. But they have to retire. Why? Because do we really want them to keep going? You know, to the 70s, okay, maybe to their 80s, to their 90s. Does ARP want to get on a plane with a 97-year-old pilot and hear an announcement like, all right, ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. We've reached a cruising altitude, so I'm going to go ahead and, oh, wait a minute. My bad. First officer tells me we are still on the runway. We're behind a Cobalt. But my point is, aging sucks, and I was kind of unhappy about it when I turned 70, and I got to thinking about you know, my dog, about Lucy, and you know, why was she so happy? Why was she so able to deal with it? Doesn't bother her. It doesn't bother dogs at all to get old. I mean, they slow down. Maybe they limp. Whatever. Doesn't seem to bother them. They're fine with it. And I decided to write a book, trying to see what it was that Lucy did that made her happy, and see if I could adapt those same behaviors and see if it would make me happy, except for drinking from the toilet. although if it worked, you know. And I'm not saying dogs are smart. That's definitely not my point. In fact, I've written many columns basically on the premise that dogs are not very smart, which is one of the reasons we love them. I will give you my favorite example of dogs' intelligence. It involves two dogs I had back in 1992. In the middle of hurricane season in Miami. Hurricane season runs from June through the following June down there. It feels like we're always in hurricane season. But anyway, in the hurricane season of 1992, we had a bad hurricane, Andrew, and it went directly over what was my house. And at the time, I had two dogs. I had a large main dog named Ernest and a small auxiliary backup dog named Zippy. Now, you need two dogs in case your main dog goes down in the hurricane. And so prior to Hurricane Andrew, I let Ernest and Zippy out every morning via a two-stage procedure. And if you've ever had a dog, you know that going out in the morning is a big deal to the dog. Dog gets very excited. Dog can't believe you thought of it, even though you do it every single day. And the dog is like, what a great idea! We're going to go out. You know, cats are like, it's about time you zit brain, you know, but dogs think everything you do is brilliant, and that's one of them. And so anyway, I would let Ernst and Zippy out every morning via a two-stage procedure. I first opened the back door to the house, and then we had a patio with a screen enclosure around it, which you need down there to keep the mosquitoes from stealing your patio furniture. So Ernest and Zippy would run across the patio to the screen door, and I'd go over there, and they're waiting for me all excited out in the screen door, and they'd run out into the yard. So that was the procedure. Over the years, we learned back door, screen door, yard. So anyway, comes Hurricane Andrew, and the screen enclosure is orbiting the Earth. It's gone. But the screen door was still there. So we have some dog owners here. Perhaps some very people who might say, no, dogs are smart. No, you know what happened. It was about a two-week learning curve, during which time I would open the back door and Ernest and Zippy would run to the screen door, which had nothing around it, and wait, because that was the procedure. So I'm not saying that dogs are smart, okay? I'm saying they're wise. There's a certain wisdom to the way they behave, you know, mostly instinct developed over thousands and thousands of years, but they do things that work very well for them, make them happy. And that's what I try to talk about in the book, the wise things that dogs do instinctively. And the thing is, there's not one thing in this book you don't already know. There's no radical new lifestyle advice in here. It's all things you know. Everybody knows everything that I talk about in the book. It's just that most of us don't do them. We do a lot of them when we're little. We have fun when we're little. We make friends when, you know, but then we get older and we get less and less good at those things. Stop doing them. Dogs never stop. They just keep doing the things that they like, that work for them, that make them happy. And that's how they go through life. And then when it's over, it's over. But they don't, right to the end, they're happy because that's what they do. They make themselves happy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the lessons. I'm not going to go too far into it because that's basically the point of the book. But one of the things, whoa, I'm on a little table here. One of the things that dogs do, one of the things that Lucy does really well, make friends. She's like instantly in love with every human being she sees and every dog she sees. She's just a very friendly dog. Loves new people, loves new dogs. Just crazy about it. Makes as many friends as she can. If she sees somebody she knows, she gets very excited. I'm terrible at that. And the older I get, the worse I am at that. I think it's a guy thing, largely, but you get older and crankier, and you're like, I don't need any new friends. I don't even like the friends I have, you know? And you're just not in touch with people. Like, I have really dear friends, old friends, that I am not 100% sure are alive. To find out, I would have to call them. And I don't do that. Guys generally don't do that. And I know this is a generalization, but I think it's valid. Women are much better about this. A woman, my wife is an example of this, can call a friend of hers for no reason and talk a long time. Guys can't do that. There has to be a purpose for a guy to call. It's like, you know, as soon as you call another guy, and what is it? What? What do we need to accomplish here? Because we're gonna, you know, we're men. We accomplish things. You know, do you need a kidney? What? It would almost seem weird to my friends if I were just call them up out of the blue and just start chattering. And I need to work on that to get better at just talking. I can see a friend of mine I have not seen in 20 years, and we can be completely caught up in 40 seconds. And then we have to start talking about sports because we don't have anything else to talk about. I think the whole reason we have sports is so men have something to talk to each other about. And my wife, she can see somebody, go away for an hour, come back and see that person again, and they can talk about what happened in that hour for four more hours. So they're just more connected, and they're better at that. So that's one of the lessons, one of the things I talk about in the book for having to try to work on. A big one for me is having fun. And I mean real fun. You do that really well when you're a kid. You have fun all the time. It's pretty much what you do. But you get less and less good at it as you get older. And at some point, a lot of us, I think, stop having fun altogether. Real fun, anyway. Lucy, she does the same thing she does when she did when she was a puppy. She likes to play ball, which is really not a game exactly. She's like, she gets a ball, which is what we call anything that's in her mouth. She has a bucket full of disgusting things. And she'll get one, you know, it's this spit-drenched, filthy wad of something, and run around the house with it, and like, you're gonna, come on, you're mine, you know, and you're supposed to pretend you want it. I don't want it, you know. But to make Lucy feel better, I'll, you know, chase after, give me the ball, Lucy. And she's like, okay. She still does that, loves to do that. She'll do that as long as she can stand up. She'll play that. But I don't do stuff like that. And I talk in the book about how, like, when you get older, you think, is it really appropriate for me to do that? It's, you know, things that you just used to naturally do, stupid fun things, you don't do so much when you're older. So fun becomes depicted in ARP commercials and in ads for senior citizen products in the form of grinning. Senior fun is always like a bunch of seniors standing around in a gym or on a golf course or on a beach, grinning at each other, and you never see why they're grinning. What the hell? Maybe they just smoked a joint. I don't know. But and so one of the things I talk about in the book is like, forget about the fact that you're old. Forget what's, you know, age appropriate or whatever. Just have fun. Do something that you used to do that was really fun for you. You know, take an inventory of your life and do that. The example I give in the book, the thing I have done, or one of the things I've done to try to reintroduce fun into my life, is I play in a rock band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, which is a band of authors. A lot of good authors in the band: Stephen King, Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Mitch Albom, Ridley Pearson, Greg Iles, Roy Blunt Jr., James McBride. Good authors. We're a terrible band. We play a genre Roy Blunt Jr. described as hard listening music. And I say, we play what I call by the rumor method of music, which is everybody is holding an instrument and playing something. And then a rumor goes around the band that there might have been a chord change. Whoa! We all change to a different chord, but not necessarily the same new chord, you know. But we really have fun. We have a lot of fun. And we started playing when we were in our 40s, and kind of over the years played less and less and less and basically stopped. And one of the things I did as a result of writing this book was write an email to the band. Come on, let's do this again. We're old, but it's still fun. So we're going to actually play a gig. It's a technical musician term. Like, you understood chord, right? And we're going to play a gig in Minneapolis in a couple of weeks at a book festival there, and everybody's going to be there. The whole band's going to be there. So I'm really looking forward to that because that's fun for me, and you kind of have to make it happen in your life, I think, instead of just sitting at home, which is, I think, more like, the older you get, the more likely what you're going to choose to do. I will say I've had one really bad experience with this band, only one, that was not fun. It was about 10 years ago. And here's the thing. So there are bands, I understand, that practice ahead of time. So they know what they're going to do, what chords they're going to play in what order, and that kind of thing. They have all that technical information already worked out. That is not our approach in the Rock Bottom Remainders. We play a show, and then we go to a bar and say, we should have practiced those songs. But by then, we're at the bar, so it doesn't... So anyway, it's like 10 years ago, we played a show in New York City. And it was a good show, it was a lot of fun. Afterward, we went to the bar at the hotel. And I found myself sitting next to Scott Turow. He was on my right. And Scott's a wonderful, brilliant guy, very funny guy, great guy. And he was telling... I will confess here that I had several vodka gimlets. And Scott was telling a very long, involved anecdote involving his spleen to the person next to him. And I'm kind of like halfway listening, talking to some other people, having my vodka gimlet. And I started listening, and I asked him, I interrupted, I said, excuse me, but do you have a spleen or not? And he goes, no, I don't. That's the point of this story. Okay. All right. Okay, cool. So he goes back to telling his anecdote, and I go back to talking to some other folks. Then he said something. I said, wait a minute. Excuse me. I thought you said you don't have a spleen. And he goes, I don't have a spleen. That's the point. I don't have a spleen. Okay. Okay. And then we all go back, and I had maybe another vodka gimlet. And if you've ever been around somebody who's had too many vodka gimlets, you maybe know what I did next, which was, for a third time, I got confused. And I said, I'm sorry, but I thought you said you don't have a spleen. And at that point, Scott took a Sharpie and pulled my sleeve up and wrote on my right forearm, wrote in big letters, no spleen. So that solved the problem for the time being. So we all went to bed, not together. We all went to bed separately. And I woke up the next morning. We had to get up early because we had to get a train to Boston. We had another show in Boston. So we wake up early, and I'm not in great shape. And I'm walking slowly toward the bathroom, and I look in the mirror, and I see something written on my arm. And I look down, and it says, no spleen. And I have no idea how those words got there. And you know that urban legend about the businessman at the hotel, an attractive woman has a drink with him and she slips something in his drink and he wakes up the next morning in his hotel bathtub packed in ice with a note on him that says that somebody has harvested his kidney. And so just for a moment I thought, oh my God, somebody harvested my spleen. And, you know, I'm panicking because I don't know where to look. And then, you know, I realize there's no incision on my body and my brain starts to reboot. And I'm thinking, like, nobody would harvest your spleen. You don't need a spleen. And Scott doesn't have a spleen. And they take spleens out of people all the time. Take them out for recreational purposes. You know, there's no market for spleens in organ harvesting circles. There's probably a saying, he's so dumb he'd harvest a spleen, you know. But it was a couple of terrifying seconds is my point. And it's like the lesson from that, it's not really a lesson from Lucy, it's just a lesson. Don't easy on the vodka gimlets is really the lesson there. So one more lesson I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to need a volunteer from the audience in a minute to help me with a reading, so somebody with a theatrical bent can think about volunteering. It's a lesson about anger, and the lesson is basically let go of your anger, unless it's something really important, which it almost never is. And again, something Lucy's very good at. I mean, it's not that dogs don't get angry. Lucy gets angry. She sits all day in my office, which is my house. It looks out on the driveway. There's a window. So she sits at the window and looks out, monitoring the situation all day. And once a week, men come, you're not going to believe this, and take our garbage. This really pisses her off. He goes crazy barking and looking at us. Are you going to can you see what they're, you're just going to let them take it? She gets very angry, but as soon as they're gone, she's back lying down, farting again. She's good, you know. She just doesn't keep it in, I'm not good at that. I tend to get irritated all the time. I talk about it in the book, in one situation, a kind of petty thing that annoys me a lot more than it should. You know, if you're in an ice cream place, let's say you're one of those ice cream places that has lots of flavors, and they have those little tasting spoons so you can sample a couple of flavors before you decide which one you want. Let's say you're in front of me in line there, okay, and there's a big line behind you, okay, and you're aware there's a line behind you. I don't mind if you take a sample. I don't mind if you take maybe a couple samples, unless it's chocolate, because we already know how chocolate tastes, right? But when you start taking like a third and a fourth and then talking to your friends about what their samples taste like, and can I try the first one again? And I want to kill you. I don't act on that impulse, but just for a moment there, I'm filled with rage that you're so, you know, considerate about the people behind you. And it makes me crazy. But it's not worth it, you know? It's like only a couple seconds, but it just will fill me with rage. And I've had to learn to just calm that down. And even as I'm on a book tour, as I say, so almost every day I'm flying somewhere, and I find myself looking at these people who do not grasp the concept of when you get to your row, step in so the people behind you can go past. How hard is that to understand? See, I'm not over it yet. So anyway, I talk in the book about the fact is, most of the time, the things that are annoying you, and I speak as somebody who drives in Miami traffic, and you would not believe what I see. Just all my theory about Miami traffic is everybody is driving according to the law of his or her individual country of origin. So you not believe in maneuvers you will see in my address. But it's not worth it. It's just not worth being angry all the time over things you can, you know, they're really not that big an effect on your life, and you're not going to change anything by being angry. And dogs are better about that. The example that I give at length in the book, do you guys have Comcast? Oh, in fact, they're here, right? I should watch what I say here, but I'm going to say it anyway. Comcast customer service. I had a situation, and I describe it in the book. A couple years ago, the guy who comes every once a week to hack the vegetation that is our yard accidentally cut two cables, the AT&T cable and the Comcast cable. So, and he came and he was very sorry, and we went on a look, and there's these two cables just dangling from the pole. So I said, you know, don't worry, we'll take care of it. I got on my cell phone and I called AT&T and said, the guy cut our cable, and he said, okay, I'll send a truck. He sent a truck, they fix it, no problem. Then I called Comcast, and I got Uzbekistan. And so I explained this, it's just the way I did the AT&T. I said, you know, the yard guy cut the cable, the TV cable. So you need, you know, somebody to fix the cable. And he's a guy in Uzbekistan reading of a script. You know, he has to follow his script. It's not his fault. He didn't write the script. This is his job. But he goes, I see, David, and they say your name a lot. I think they think that will calm you down. I see, David. David, I'm so sorry that your cable has been is not working. And I will work to resolve that problem, David. Great, thank you. He said, David, can you tell me, are your cable boxes all turned on? And I'm being patient at this point. I say, that's really not the issue here. The cable is cut, so I'm not sure the physics of this, but basically the TV shows are spilling out onto the lawn. They're not getting into the house now, so it really doesn't matter if the boxes are turned on or not. I see, David. I'm sorry, David. Can you tell me, I need you to look and tell me the serial number of the main cable. You know, like, he's reading his script, trying to get it going for him. You know, and I'll admit, I lost my temper. Didn't do me any good, didn't do him any good. He probably thinks, well, I talked to an idiot today, doesn't even know how to check his serial number, you know. But here's how I dealt with that, and it's how I try to deal with anger a lot. When it's an advantage of being a humor writer, you can take a situation like that and turn it into, you can write something about it and it sort of get it out that way. And I wrote something, it's a little play about, a revenge play about Comcast customer service. I need somebody from the audience to play the part of a Comcast customer service representative. All I need is somebody willing to be cheerful and perky and who can read. Come on up. Yeah, come on up. It's Tinkerbell. I know this woman. This look at, show them your t-shirt.
The remainder.
She's got a remainder t-shirt and a Tinkerbell wand. I can't remember your name. Karen. This is Karen, ladies and gentlemen. She's insane. Come on. You're on this side. You have to step on the table here, Karen. It's a little scary. So anyway, you're gonna read the part in red, okay? And just your Comcast customer service. I have a fantasy. In this fantasy, late one night, a cable executive calls 911, only to discover that as a cost-cutting measure, the police department has outsourced its 911 operation to the cable company.
Thank you for choosing 911. What is your emergency?
A man broke into my house. He has an axe.
May I have your name and address?
Bob Timmons, 123 Belchwater Road. Please hurry.
Thank you, Bob. Bob, I understand you are saying you have an intruder in your house?
Yes, with an axe. Please send somebody.
Bob, I am sorry that an intruder with an axe is in your house, and I will help you to resolve this problem.
Please hurry. He's coming up the stairs.
Bob, in order to assist you, I'm going to need to ask you some questions. Is that okay, Bob?
Yes, just hurry.
Bob, first, can you tell me, did you give permission for this intruder to enter your house, Bob?
No, for God's sake, he broke in with an axe.
Thank you, Bob. I understand you are saying that the intruder does not have permission to be in your house at 123 Elkwater Road. Is that correct?
No, I'm at 123 Belchwater Road.
So, Bob, you're saying you are at 123 Belchwater Road.
Yes.
But the intruder is at 123 Elkwater Road, Bob.
No, he's here. He's breaking down the bedroom door. For the love of God, send help.
Bob, so that I can better assist you, can you please describe the axe?
On the executive's end of the line, there are shouts, sounds of a struggle, screams, then silence. A new voice comes on the line. Who is this?
This is 911. Is this Bob?
No.
Do you have an emergency?
Not anymore.
So the problem has been resolved?
Yes.
Would you be willing to take a brief customer satisfaction survey regarding your 911 experience?
Ladies and gentlemen, Karen, thank you. Good job. So anyway, that's kind of a brief overview of how the book came to be and what's in it. It's a bunch more lessons. I won't go through them all now. There's one thing I want to add now, which is going to, then we'll go to questions. I finished this book last year, and I was supposed to go out and promote it last October. In August, is the day before, 2 days before my daughter was getting ready to go to college, she developed a severe medical condition, a severe and acute and dangerous. And she didn't go to college, and I canceled my book tour and pretty much canceled my life. And if you've ever had a sick child, you know how your life changes. And I was pretty sure for a while there I was never going to write another word, and I was never going to go on any book tour, and this book wasn't going to happen. She got better, and I just want to stress that. She's okay now, and she did get to college. She's a student at Duke now. Yay. But for quite a while, it looked like that was never going to happen. And so we got through that, and they were talking about, now we'll publish the book in the spring, this spring. I asked my editor at Scheinman & Schuster, Priscilla Payton, I said, I feel kind of funny going out and talking about life lessons when the biggest lesson I learned after I wrote the book, and I'd like to include that in the book. And so they changed the production schedule all around and let me write a last chapter. So there's that chapter, that story's in the book. And I don't mean it to be a downer, it's not. I learned something really important from that experience, as harrowing as it was. I'm only telling you this because I want you to be aware that the last chapter is gonna feel very different from the other ones. The last lesson is quite a bit different where it came from. And just want you to be aware of that so it doesn't come as too much of a surprise to you when you read it. Anyway. On that downer of a note, I'd be happy to take some questions. We have two volunteers with, unless you're paid professionals, I don't know, I shouldn't. Anyway, we have two women with, if I can presume that, gender, I don't, anymore. You can't say anything anymore about anything. But anyway, these two human beings, will come to you, and you can ask your question so that everybody can hear it. If anybody got any problems at home you want to share with the group. Okay, gentleman right here.
Would you please channel Joe Biden and tell us about your reactions to hugging your wonderful assistant?
I don't hug my assistant. What do you... Oh, did I hug her? Karen! Okay, well, I guess that goes my presidential ambitions. Well, just by show of hands, anybody here not running for the Democratic nomination for it? Okay, a couple people are not. No, Karen did. Was it okay that I hug?
I did. I would still vote for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Man, I didn't even know what you were talking. See, I did that with me and Joe Biden. We're like old people. We don't even notice we do these things, you know? I didn't inhale her hair. Did I? Yeah. Any other? That's it?
We have a daughter and a son. They're 11 and 12. I have two kids. They're 11 and 12.
Kids, okay.
I'm impressed you got yours to college. What life lesson do you have for us as parents to get our kids to college?
Oh, God. Well, get them on the sailing team. Yeah. I didn't mention this. My daughter's playing varsity football at Duke. Well, we just went through that, and it's like so radically changed from when I went through, even when my son went, which was like 20 years ago. It's awful. It's just awful. The pressure on the parents and on the kids. And we said at the beginning, you know, SOAF doesn't matter. You know, wherever you get in, it's going to be fine, which is statistically true. You know, it's so much less important where they go to college than they think it is. And it doesn't matter. By the time it gets around, it's like, you know, everybody's just obsessed with everybody, where everybody went. And then there's the expense of it. Like, somewhere at these colleges, they are setting fire to piles of money. And maybe that's how they heat the buildings, because it's unbelievable expense. And the other thing is, they always talk about class size. Like, you know, they compete with smaller and smaller. Like, so Harvard class size is zero. It's just... Professor sits alone in a classroom, you know, heated by money. But I don't envy you. Maybe the bubble will have burst, and maybe this whole scandal will make it a little saner. But I don't know. It's crazy, crazy.
Is there another movie in the works?
Well, I'm sure there's many. You mean one with connected to me?
Connected to you, yes. I loved your first one.
Not that I'm aware of. I had one book was made into a movie. It was Big Trouble, it was called. And yeah, thank you. Although that was a really snake bit movie, because I thought it was pretty funny, but it had a bomb in an airplane. Nobody gets hurt, but there was nuclear bomb in an airplane. Well, a bad guy gets hurt. He gets blown up by a nuclear bomb, which is a lot of firepower for one guy, but it was very bad. The thing is, that was supposed to come out on the day after 9/11, and that didn't happen, you know. And I'm not by any means comparing my tragedy to anybody else's, but that's what happened to that. It did well in, you know, cable, I guess, but if they haven't cut your cord, it's all over my lawn.
Feels like a foolish question, but isn't it hard being funny all the time?
Well, that's a stupid question. No, that's a very good question. Yeah, I mean, if you want to write humor, the problem is twofold, really. One is, if you write humor, it's supposed to be funny. And like, I always tell people, like, if George Will writes a column, you can read it, and, you know, nobody's promising you any particular result. You know, you might agree, you might disagree, you might be bored, but it doesn't promise anything. If it says humor at the top, you know, you're kind of saying something. You're going to laugh, you know, and if people go, I didn't think that was funny, you know, you have failed. So the possibility of failure is always there. And it's hard to keep thinking of new things, because, you know, you think of a joke and that's kind of it for that joke for the rest of your life. You can't use that joke again. You have to come up with another one. And another one, another one. So that, to me, that's hard. The only thing that keeps me doing it is the realization that if I don't, then I will have to get a real job. And I don't want to find that. So it ended up being my entire career. But I don't want to compare it to coal mining, you know. But I will say the coal miners, when they go into the mine, know what they have to do. There's some coal, they're going to get it. When a humor writer sits down in front of a screen, he's got nothing. You know, and this is, you know, staring at it, thinking, I'm never going to be funny again. You know, that's generally my mood. So I hope that's an answer. Don't, if you're thinking about doing this, don't do it. Yeah.
How hard is it to do the year in rewind?
The year in review?
Yeah.
Every year I write a review of the entire year that is supposed to be amusing, and it's hard because I usually sit down around like in Halloween, roughly, and start looking at the stories that happened over the course of the year, and it's almost like they're almost all tragedies, you know, or just bad news, because that's what the news is. And I thought, how am I supposed to make this funny? So it's slow. I'm making it sound like my job is just awful. It's really, I like my job. I don't want to. But it takes a long time, and I do it because people really like that. People respond really well to the year in review, so I keep doing it. But it's probably the hardest thing I write, I would say. Yeah.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I had to be here.
Newsrooms are using AI to write stories. Do you think that a robot can write your column?
That's been the case for about 10 years now. As soon as I taught it what a booger was, it was off and running, you know? I just sit around and drink Mai Tais all day.
Apparently in the last couple of years, late night comics have had a field day because they've had so much material. Has your writing and the task of being a humorist changed for you in the last 2 years?
What in our earth could you be referring to? A little bit. I was never that much of a political humorist. I kind of peripherally touched on it, except I do go every year, and I'll probably do it this year, go to Iowa and New Hampshire in the political conventions because I find those to be very amusing. But I kind of steer away from political jokes because there are so many people cranking them out, as you say, on late night. There's just teams and teams of writers. And it's a little bit of a complaint on my part. The humor sounds like a lot alike to me. You know, it's basically, what an idiot. It's kind of I know, but how many times can you say it? You know, it seems to be infinite, but you know, we seem to have kind of lost a certain level of sophistication and nuance and cleverness in our political humor. And it's just kind of like you have to show you're on the right side, pound it pretty hard. I don't find it to be that creative, to be honest. And I'm hoping eventually we get through this period. Yeah.
So I was hoping you could settle this. My husband thinks you know, and I think you don't know. Did you know that Comcast is headquartered in Philadelphia?
I actually said that, didn't I? Or something like it? So we can just rewind the tape. I'm aware of that, and I'm sure there are people here who work for Comcast, and I'm sure they're wonderful, competent human beings who have never been to Uzbekistan and would totally understand the concept of the cable is cut.
You wrote a great book called Very Bad Songs, and I just wondered whether you and Neil Diamond ever had a conversation.
I just to back up and explain that, I wrote a column long ago, and this was not the point of the column, but I said in there that I was not crazy about the song I Am I Said by Neil Diamond, in which he says, sings with great intensity and passion in his voice, I am I said to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair. And my feeling is like, well, no shit, Neil. It's that's because it's a chair. It's furniture, Neil. The table probably didn't pick up on it either. Yeah. Could you not have taken 10 more seconds in your busy life to think of a better rhyme than that, you know? So I wrote that in a column. That was not the point of the column. It was just some, there was probably no point to the column. It rarely is, but, and you think Salman Rushdie got in trouble. There are some intense Neil Diamond people out there, and I heard from all of them, and these spit-covered letters would say, like, I mean, how dare you criticize? He's a great artist. I listened to Heartlight 14 times, and it cured my goiter, Mr. Barry. And you know, so I wrote another column about that. He said, whoa, I really tick off the Neil Diamond people. I wrote a column just quoting these letters. And then I got a whole new outpouring of mail from the people who agreed with me, who hate that song and hate wanted to tell me about other songs they hated. So I wrote another column about songs people hate, you know. And this just opened the floodgates. And, you know, I just got thousands and thousands of pieces of mail about songs people hate. I mean, people say Americans don't care about the issues, but this this is an issue that Americans care about. So I ended up writing a whole book about it, the Book of Bad Songs. And I still, people will still come up to me and say, like, you know that song about the horse with no name? I hate that song. I had a friend, the late Rich Jenny, who was a comedian, just a brilliant comedian, his line about that was, you're in the desert, you got nothing to do, name the freaking horse, you know? Rich, they're applauding your joke. Anyway, so to answer your question, one time I was watching, not too long after that column came out, Katie Couric was interviewing Neil Diamond on TV, and she said, what's the deal with this, you know, nobody heard it all, not even the chair. And he started laughing. He said, yeah, some guy wrote a column about that. So, Neil knew who I was. Well, sort of, you know. So that was pretty cool. But I actually like Neil Diamond, but anyway.
Was working at Tropic Magazine as much fun as it sounds like it should have been?
Yes. I don't know who said that. Yes. The Sunday magazine at the Miami Herald, when I got there, it was called Tropic Magazine. And it was, that's kind of the height of the newspaper industry, which is now in steep decline. But back then, the industry had tons of money. And they could send us all over. We went all over the place to do stories for Tropic. And it was run by an absolute lunatic named Gene Weingarten. I'll tell you my favorite Gene Weingarten management style. Gene is this guy. He looks like Groucho Marx, and including like the nose glasses. He looks like he's wearing Groucho glasses, but he's not. He said, he was our boss, but he was this completely wild, out of control guy, and he didn't follow any of the rules of the Knight Ridder, which is the company that owned the Miami Herald. Anyway, they sent this memo around to all the department heads, including Gene, saying, we're going to be bringing around some stock analysts on this date, and we would, you know, here's your time. We want you to be prepared to give a 10-minute presentation about your operation when we come to your, you know, locale. So Gene didn't read that, so he didn't know this was happening. So we're just kind of hanging around Tropic Magazine offices, and there's a big conference table in the middle of the office, and suddenly the door opens, and in walks all these guys in suits, serious-looking guys. And they tell Gene they're here for their presentation, and Gene has no memory. I mean, he never saw it. So he quickly decides he's going to tell them what he was working on right then, which was the cover to a story about a guy who was an expert on hurricanes in Miami. And the cover was going to be a kind of a funny cover. It was going to be him hanging from a bar, and then they were going to run it sideways, as if the wind was pushing his whole body sideways. So Gene is trying to explain this to these guys in suits, not doing very well, and then he decides to show them. So he calls to the art director, Philip Brooker. He says, Philip, can I see the picture of the guy getting blown? And so, no, it gets worse. So everybody kind of chortles, you know, it's like a little awkward, but you know, okay, we got it. Except for Gene. Gene thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard, even though he's the one who said it. So Gene kind of collapses on the conference table. So he's now face down on the conference table, and he's got this real high-pitched weeping laugh. So we watch this for a minute. The little goes on a little too long. And then, you know, nobody's moved. The suit guys are all looking, and we're all just like, oh, God, this is awful. And Gene comes up, and, you know, we're presuming he's going to get going, but he is once again struck by the incredible life-threatening humor of the situation. It goes right back down again. And he's quaking, and again, it goes way too long, silence except for Gene weeping. He comes up again and goes down again, you know. And the third time he came up, they were gone. That was the Gene's presentation to the stock analysts. So anyway, that was what it was like working at Tropic. But he was my editor. He was the responsible person over me at Tropic Magazine. Yeah.
How do you cure writer's block?
How do you cure writer's block? I don't believe in it. I think every writer is in a constant state of block. I mean, unless you're a terrible writer and then just pours out of you. Not unlike diarrhea. But you know, writing, like I said, writing is hard, any kind of writing. And you know, it takes time to do it. And I think what happens is people want it to be easier. And so they kind of, if it doesn't come right away, they say, I'm blocked, I can't get it. But I think really what you need to do is just stay there and look at the screen until something, even if it's terrible, write it. And then, you know, look at it again, next day, whatever. Keep at it. I think a lot of writers, professional writers, what happens, and I've known people this happen too, they write something, a book, whatever, they work really hard on it. And, I mean, it is hard, and they finally get published, and it does well. And then suddenly you're in this whole new world where you're a writer now, and you get invited to writers' conferences. And guess what you do at writers' conferences? You don't write. You talk about writing, which is so much easier than writing. And people tell you you're great, and where do you get your ideas, and you can talk about it, and then you get invited to other writers' conferences. They're all over the place all the time. You can have, you know, if you're a success, if it sold, if your book did really well, you can do that for years. And it's so much easier than writing. The next time you go and sit down to write, it's like, I'd rather go to another writers' conference, you know? And I think in some of the classic cases of block, that's really what was happening. But for the most part, and I know a lot of writers, people do it for a living. In the end, what they do is they just sit in front of the screen every day until something comes, even though there's days when hardly anything does. And that's how you get past writer's block. But you don't say is, I've got writer's block, so I can't do anything. I need an external force to come along and correct it for me. No, it's in you. You have to do it. That's what I think. Also, coal mining. You never hear a coal miner say, man, I just can't dig any coal today. I've got coal block. One more question. So no pressure. This
no,
better be hilarious.
No pressure. Do you laugh when you're writing?
Never. Never. I have never cracked myself up. To me, it's like the analogy I would draw is if you are a magician, you have practiced, you know, for months and months so you can make the quarter disappear out of your hand. When you finally get it, you never go, wow, where did it go? You know, so if you've been building a joke all day, it's not going to strike you as hilarious. So anyway, thank you all for coming out. Thanks to the library. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.